This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
You go through that challenge every time you build a new product as well, right? You could have an established business and you're like, okay, I think we see an opportunity for another product line here. And as soon as you're building that out, you're like, oh my God, I'm back into like startup mode again, where I'm just at the very beginning. There's this huge risk. Like, we're making some big assumptions here that we haven't validated. And we could spend 3 or 6 months working on this and it can just net out to zero. That's the exciting part of it as well, right? So I'll give you a great example. So currently we have two services, as you know. We have our tenant credit and background check service that helps you landlords screen their tenants before they lease out to them. And then once they're on their lease, we have our rent guarantee program that's more of like an insurtech service that takes away the risk of tenants not paying, damaging their property, and it insures all those financial risks away. The third service that now we're actually building currently, and again, this is kind of like we've got the butterflies when we're pushing it out there, is that we realize that due to a lot of the eviction bans and restrictions on what landlords can do in regards to delinquent tenants, especially during the pandemic, a lot of landlords have been kind of painted into a corner where they're like, I don't have any recourse to basically apply towards tenants that just feel like don't paying the rent. You know, if you can't evict them, then what possible incentive do they have to actually pay? So we found that, hey, there's a lot of demand out there for people wanting to report delinquent tenants to the bureaus, to the credit bureau. So at least it would impact their credit score if they don't pay their rent. So with that assumption in mind, they say, hey, look, it seems like there's definitely demand and interest on doing this. How do we then take this and build another feature onto our service to be able to implement it? Well, the second question is now, well, first of all, you know, if a tenant doesn't pay the rent, how do we report that? Well, first of all, how do we even validate that that's actually the case and get over that whole he said, she said type of interaction? Because a landlord can come in and report a bad tenant for any other reason. So we need to kind of have some proof because, you know, we are impacting somebody's credit history, which is very negative. So then, okay, well, the next step, I guess, is maybe we should collect the rent payment on their behalf. So why don't we set up a kind of easy to use, low cost, fast kind of like rent collection platform that any small residential landlord can kind of just plug into, log in with their bank account, invite the tenant to do the same, and then just set up those recurring monthly payments. And guess what? If there's an NSF, now we've got proof the tenant hasn't paid. We can take that, integrate to the Equifax API, and report that delinquency and give them the chance to obviously pay up and remove that past due amount. So that's basically how we're building our next product. And it's scary. It's exciting. We'll see how it'll work. And again, trying to be super lean and get something out that's very rough. Obviously, instead of, you know, building something that's super sexy and amazing and, you know, getting 10,000 customers, no, we're going to build something that barely works. We're going to release it with 100 of our best customers right now that are very friendly, get them to play with it, tell us how they like it, and then slowly, incrementally start, you know, widening, you know, making it available to more people, maybe do a one province or one city launch initially. And as it gets better, we'll obviously make it available to everybody.
Yeah, I think the process you've outlined there is one that focuses on the why, not just the what. So the challenge is people will talk to their customers, try to understand what the problem is and what they want as a solution. And it's disheartening when you realize what they're asking for is what many companies already provide. They just don't know about the solution. Frankly, I'm better off just, you know, referring them to this existing product rather than building it myself. Yeah. And that's when people make a mistake. You need to understand why. It's not about what the problem is. Why is this a problem? Why do they want what they think they want? When you're thinking about the why, you're already building on the what. And that's when you can build transformational products. Like in your case, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, but when you interviewed your base of landlords, I don't believe they said to you, I want a rent guarantee product that does this. I'm sure they said to you, our challenge is people aren't paying on time. And that was for you to then take that challenge and brainstorm ways you can solve that.
Absolutely. And I think that's where the magic happens is in the what. It's your kind of, that's when you can get creative and really kind of come up with the best solution and the best product. But you nailed it. I mean, like really understanding the why and understanding the problem, that's really the crux of it. And you can't do that if you just kind of blindfoldedly build an extensive product without really kind of interviewing your customers constantly and understanding the why.
So look, on the concept of an MVP.
Yeah.
On one hand, as a VC, I'm always pushing startups to just get out there and try to get product market fit. But on the other hand, as someone that's also a real estate investor and a principal of real estate, I can be a customer to a lot of prop tech solutions. I also don't want half thought out solutions that are buggy and have a lot of problems. How do you draw this line between an MVP that's scrappy versus a full fledged V1 that doesn't solve the need? What's the right approach here? How would you build a product from scratch?
I think it's a good question, Zane. And I think, you know what, I think it depends. There's some more nuance to that, to the right answer there, depending on what market you're tackling, what kind of type of customers you're going after. Obviously, if you're building a really fleshed out B2B solution for Fortune 500 companies, it needs to be a bit, obviously, a bit more stable than just kind of like a simple B2C product, low-cost B2C product. I think that the answer there is that there's different types of customers out there. You have the early adopters and you have the fast followers, and then you have the kind of like, you know, late adopters once everybody else is using it. And there's always going to be early adopters that are happy to try crazy things and products that don't work, right? So you have to really kind of find out who they are, or you have to find them and try, you know, try your product with the early adopters. They're going to be willing to give you the time of day to try it out. And you know, you may not personally be an early adopter yourself, or you might look at the product and say, well, you know, the risk of this thing breaking or not functioning properly, it's going to cost me more than the value I get from, you know, using this thing. And that's something you have to keep in mind as well as you're developing that product. And you won't find that out until you go and talk to customers. So I would say you're still at the beginning. The beauty of it is that you have no reputation, you have nothing to lose, right? So, you know, that's very freeing, because you can go out there with really crappy products and even rebrand if you have to, like 6 months later, once you get it right. But definitely take advantage of the fact that you know, you have no reputation to uphold, and just, you know, iterate on the spot and launch things as early as possible.
And the challenge is, once you start charging for a product that isn't built properly, you're obliged to make sure you deliver value. Otherwise, be willing to return all of that back.
Absolutely.
I see a lot of crowdfunding campaigns really go sideways here, where they raise a lot of money for a product that they think is cool. And that's the whole point of crowdfunding, right? To get moving quickly. The challenge is, now you've raised a lot of money in pre-orders and you realize, I can't actually build this, and this isn't what I want to build. And suddenly you've got all this money sitting in the account, and you know, there's fees you've had to pay to get that revenue too. Now, in the spirit of talking about action here, I think it also comes down to what resources you have access to. If you have a technical person on your team, that's a great thing. If you don't, then you've really got to think about, do you want to go build a fully functional prototype? Sometimes a UX workflow is fine to use. You can use tools out there like Adobe InDesign or Figma or Sketch, where you can literally very quickly get a template built with some workflows and show it to a customer and say, look, you click on this, this is what happens. Does this solve the problem? Rather than going out and hiring building a full-on back-end and front-end solution, which can cost 100 times more and way harder to change, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing, Zane, is that the getting to the point where you're getting the customer feedback is the most important point. Like, you need to get there no matter what, right? So, I think you nailed it in the fact that if you have something to show, people will be willing to talk to you. Or if you have something that somewhat works, you'll get a much better conversation out of them. Because, you know, when we first started, we had those kind of high level conversations with a PowerPoint deck and say, hey, well, this is kind of what we're thinking of building. These are the cool features that it's going to do. But it's hard for people to visualize. And when they see that you're not committed, they're not committed to giving you proper feedback, right? So it's kind of a bit of a give and take kind of game. So yes, absolutely, you can start out with kind of just like a Figma or InDesign kind of a UI mockup, and get that very early kind of feedback from some of the some of the friends you have in your network and stuff like that. But then you kind of have to build something that kind of, you know, works and become a bit more of a serious company for people wanting to kind of like talk to you and invest more time to help you build your solution.
Yeah, and also when it comes to building technology itself, there's lots of off-the-shelf libraries and APIs you can plug into. Don't reinvent the wheel. See where you can license and use other technologies. For example, a lot of PropTech startups have an interface where, you know, there's a map needed. We'll go use Esri, or go use some type of GIS solution, which quickly allows you to move ahead and build the true value rather than trying to build something from scratch.
That's exactly right. And for folks that are non-tech, they don't really realize the difference between kind of like just kind of like a Frankenstein solution through a bunch of integrations versus like a fully native, beautiful app. As long as it kind of does the job and it looks okay, you know, they're willing to try it out and play around with it. So everybody should definitely, you know, even if it ends up being more expensive, like having to just subscribe to a billion services to be able to kind of launch that, it's still way cheaper than investing, you know, 3 months to really flesh out and build out a product, which you're going to have to change and iterate anyways, because it's way too early.
Look, it's a temptation for non-technical co-founders. I was once a non-technical, you know, CEO. Now I've spent a lot of time and I can do some basic programming, and you know, I like building things and mocking them up just for fun. And I've realized, as a non-technical person, you don't appreciate how much there is out there. There are existing libraries and templates you can just plug and play and get moving on. I used to think you have to build everything out from scratch. You've got to create a full feature list. Nonsense. Yeah. There are templates and libraries you can build online. You can go get a WordPress template if you need to. You know, and these things might cost $100 or maybe $20, but you've just saved yourself way more than the hourly rate you're paying to a software engineer. And you focus that engineer that you have access to on building things that are really going to move the needle with the value of what you're offering.
Right.
That might be how you integrate machine learning. It might be how you take data from one place to another and do something with that data that the customer needs, rather than spending all your time focusing on something that isn't going to add value. The color of that button might not be very important. Yeah. You know,
exactly.
Don't obsess with that. Focus on what they want.
I think you struck on two very important points, Zane. I think it's, first of all, is the fact that, you know, the technological barrier to starting a company has become so much lower now. And, you know, I'm definitely, for an entrepreneur, I'm definitely a bit on the older side at 35 now. But when I started my grassroots, you know, business in 2009, none of this stuff existed. Like, I was coming out of like one of the top universities in Toronto, U of T, and we didn't have any incubators, no accelerators, no VCs, no angels. None of that stuff existed. And I was a real entrepreneur. Like, we started a company that we're making $500,000 a year, you know, door to door kind of sales over the summer. And there was no support, nothing whatsoever. Very difficult to build that website, to kind of process payments online, to build, to have a CRM. Like, all this stuff had to be custom built, whereas now there's a solution for everything. You just have to take the time to actually solve it or to look into it and find it. Another thing that I think really helps as well is kind of really, you know, do not be a loner. Don't think you can do this as a lone wolf. You have to kind of insert yourself in the ecosystem and learn from others. Like, the best thing you can do is just take part into an incubator, go and sit next to other founders, because you'll find that the problems that you have, 80% of the problems that you have, other people are having as well, and have come up with a solution. So your best friend will be somebody that's maybe like a year ahead of you, because they've gone through the exact same headaches, and it can save you so much time and effort by just kind of guiding you the right way. So definitely seek out that mentorship, ask for technological solutions and you know ways to do things, and even kind of, you know, how do I put together my cap table? How do I find a co-founder? There's so much help on that. The other thing that you struck upon
just to add to that, I think also some customers are eager to see innovation happen and are willing to be very, very active and be much more than just a customer. So there's a chance here to get customers to invest in your idea, or even to become an advisor of some sort. So that's something that I think I find with real estate people. There are some really sharp people in real estate who yearn to sort of see a startup solve a key problem, and they'll give you very valuable advice. Go ahead on your second point.
Yeah, and to add more to that as well, I think the fact that you mentioned that, you know, unfortunately, you know, the real estate space tends to be a bit more closed off, I think, to the outside world. And I think the value of having an advisor that's been there for 20 years is really important, because you'll find that it's a very small world. A lot of folks know each other. There's a lot of like kind of weird processes and way things are done that you can't see from the outside, and you have to have that advisor on the inside to tell you kind of how things work. So absolutely. The second point was that you mentioned that, hey, don't be a perfectionist, right? Like, the color of the button doesn't matter. You have such limited resources in the beginning that, and you have such a long to-do list, that, you know, you're very tempted to kind of get everything right. Right. And that's really going to hurt your growth, because you have to realize, like, you know, are they going to care about this? Is this something that I should really kind of worry about? Or should I spend that time building that new feature that's got real value add that can really solve the problem, right? So 80-20 is the way to go. Like, with 20% of the effort to get 80% of the results, and then move on to the next thing as fast as you can. You can always come back later to kind of fix the small things later on if they become a real issue.
And there's definitely a time to optimize your UX. I'm a big proponent of having really good UX. But it's not at the very beginning, especially if you're not a UX-driven platform and you're doing more of a you know, a process or whatever. And I mean, in your case, Vila, why don't you walk us through sort of the value that you're providing when you offer the tenant screening to landlords?
I think so. You know what? I kind of disagree with that. I know a lot of, like, especially a lot of like tech focused founders, you know, don't like UX. There's one thing where I kind of disagree, because I find that the experience and the look and feel communicates a lot more about your company than you think, even though the functionality is the same. But just putting together a bit more polished and kind of well thought out interface with a customer, you're really kind of communicating a lot. You're making yourself seem a lot more serious and a lot more bigger than you are, right? And that builds credibility, which is something that's key in real estate, especially.
Totally agree on that. I just want to jump in and say that UX perfectionism go really well together, hand in hand. Often you'll find the best UX designers are true perfectionists. You've got to kill that trait when it comes to launching a company.
Yes.
80% is enough. To get that last 20% is going 100%. To take three times more work. And sometimes you just have to say, like, is it worth me trying to optimize every little feature? You're not at the level where you're like a Facebook or, you know, when I ran my company, it mattered how the button looked because we were an ad platform.
Of course.
Right. Yeah. And our whole business was about that. But at the beginning, we just had to make sure the ads actually did display and that, you know, we were charging correctly. We were, you know, we weren't charging more than we were supposed to charge. That was the key make or break. Eventually, though, you get to a point where optimizations make sense, but it's definitely not at the MVP stage.
No, you're absolutely right.
We'll be right back.